Live from the belly of a wooden horse. This is Derailed Trains of Thoughts. Okay, Nick, this is one of the strangest locations you've dragged me to.
At least it's not Wooden Badger.
What? we're inside this giant wooden horse.
And there's all these people telling us to be quiet, but we're like, we gotta get this podcast done. We only do one a month anyways.
We better do this pretty quick, Nick. Yeah. They don't look too happy about us being here.
I'm kind of mad about this some guy who got hit in their ankle or something.
Oh, weird.
I know.
All right, well.
What about this princess, but isn't it always?
Yeah, it's always the dames.
Yeah,
it's So, welcome to wherever we are, folks, and hopefully we'll make this an interesting podcast for you. Hopefully there's not too much of an echo here. How have you been, Nick?
I've been pretty busy. I've been in and out all month.
Yeah, this has been a very busy month for you.
Yeah, I'm gone, I'm here. Last week got back from a mission trip to West Virginia, leaving tomorrow, which I'll be back by the time this thing comes out. Going on a family vacation, looking good. It finally rained here.
Yes, thank goodness.
I know.
Well, as you probably know, folks, it's been quite a drought around the Midwest lately.
Or like about 50% of the country, I guess.
Yeah, so kind of crazy. And I actually just got, it's been interesting for me too, I actually just got a new job at a new place. We'll be transitioning out of working desk clerk stuff and doing more full-time videography.
Nice.
So that'll be fun. I'm not sure how it's going to affect some of the other projects that I had originally planned to work on.
Like, got a lot of projects now, Tim.
Well, yeah. Well, between doing that videography for that and for my church, I'm going to be like, I'm not sure I'm going to actually have a chance to do the side project that I, the video, videos. Like, I'm going to be editing enough video as it is. I don't know. So we'll see, but we'll always be here for you listeners to do our bi-weekly or monthly.
Our monthly or bi-monthly. Or
it's monthly now.
Semi-annual or
or somewhat regular podcast.
Just because we're here less doesn't mean it's less awesome.
There you go. But we'll move on with that and get into the main highlight, which you're all waiting for, and that is our story school. So today, folks, we're going to be talking about what makes a classic. And of course, if we knew this verbatim, that means we'd be very published, celebrated writers right now. But we'll give this our best shot.
Yes. Well, because classic's kind of a slippery term. Depends who you talk to. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain things that most people say, yes, this is a classic.
Yes,
you know,
definitely.
There's something written by Homer people call a classic.
Uh-huh.
A lot of, you know, there's a lot of things like, you know, Dickens is classic, Mark Twain. But then get into more iffy things, you know, especially if it's more modern, you got to like instant classic. What do you think? Can you be an instant classic? Is time necessary?
Time is a very important factor because there's some stories that people thought a bestseller of the day, but several years down the road, no one remembers anymore. And you can't pronounce it a classic upon arrival if you're the company putting it out. I always used to make fun of like Disney, like on their home video sets, yeah. Say Walt Disney Classic, or even better, like the Walt Disney Masterpiece. And I'd be like, that came out in the theaters like a year ago. You can't call it a classic if it's less than like 10 years old.
Well, so I was thinking, here's my, I got four things I think make a classic.
Okay.
You can argue them or give examples or take them apart.
I had a couple things too, so we'll see if any of these are on the same
thing. Just take one at a time then.
Sure, okay.
I have foundational.
Okay.
Meaning a classic has to change how things work or how artists after them do things or think about things.
Right, yeah. And this is one I kind of thought of. Something that defines a genre in a lot of ways.
Which I think is why it's harder to get classics as you get farther away from the birthplace of
story,
the novel, of the movie.
Right.
I mean, you can still, but there's more and more people making stuff, and less of it is truly shifting how people think about the medium.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk about some examples here.
I'll throw Dickens out there because he's kind of the English literature version. Because he basically solidified and there were a lot of people serializing novels at the time, but he was, you know, the one that made it into kind of an art form, I guess, or at least he would talk about that gets into my other things that I was going to mention. Okay, let me move away from Dickens. I'll bring them up for another one.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of the Roman classics or the Greek classics or even the, you know, they kind of determined how the West thinks. You know, Aristotle and Plato. I mean, those are not fiction. Well, so, I mean, there's also the, you know, the Oedipus Rex.
Yeah.
You know, even Freud's talking about Oedipus and, you know.
They did, even those philosophers, though, they did do some writing about, mainly they were focusing on plays and dramatic works, but still same principles.
Well, because dramatic works, actually, the novel as it stands really wasn't a form. I mean, you had epics, which were all in poetry, you know, the Odyssey and the Iliad are poetic.
Or Beowulf.
Or Beowulf. And Beowulf is classical because it's found, it's like the epitome of what that time period's literature was, or at least what we have of it.
Right.
Yeah. And sometimes it's easy to be good classic because you're the only one that survived.
This is true.
Or you're the Epic of Gilgamesh, and you know.
Right. Or the Canterbury Tales.
Canterbury Tales, exactly.
And because, because in a lot of that, you know, in that time, if you had books, you were talking, it was the Bible. Most actual fictional stories were more often plays until you had printing press. And I suppose, really, when did the novel really start taking off as a form?
See, I don't know the exact dates. I always think it's somewhere around the Dickens time.
Yeah, I always think of it as a Victorian era sort of
invention. At least in the West. I don't know. I mean, you got this Tale of Genji thing in Japan.
Oh, really?
I don't know how old it is, but it's considered, or Don Quixote is one of the first novels.
That's true. That goes back to, like, I guess it's like the end of the Middle Ages is kind of when it's, like, wasn't it like 1600s when that came out?
Sounds right.
Okay. But then I guess in the novel, then you've got your specific works that really define genres, like Treasure Island, Pirates, Sherlock Holmes, detective story. Although even though he's not really the original mystery writer,
he kind of defines.
Yeah,
you know, that's why Conan's classic. He kind of defines that, you know, barbarian. You know, because there's our friend Nathan was telling me about Call the Conqueror, which by the same guy, but never went off in the same manner, so it didn't define the genre.
Or in the same author as Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs, who, you know, Tarzan is kind of a genre of his own. But then also he did the John Carter of Mars, which really influenced a lot of the science fiction that came on later. Yeah. Fortunately, the movie didn't catch on quite as big because everyone else had already done the ideas. But
I know, I remember reading The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, which was, he was a contemporary of Dickens. And apparently it's one of the first solid mysteries.
Well, because they credit Edgar Allan Poe with really creating the mystery genre.
But that's more of a short. He never wrote novels, did he?
I don't think. Not that I know of. But he's more known for short stories.
And and his are classic because he kind of focused the short story.
True.
Well, and that's why Hemingway's classic, because he kind of reinvented a style of writing. There's this, this very sparse staccato sort of way of writing things. Mark Twain is classic because it's like kind of summarizes America, you know, so it's like the American classic.
Right. I guess if we were looking in terms of modern of a medium that's still very new and is constantly coming up with the classics seem more regular because they're more new. In film, you've got movies like, Star Wars is clearly a classic.
Yeah, which, you know, defined a whole way of making movies.
Basically created, that and Jaws basically created the blockbuster.
Yeah.
I mean, you had your major motion pictures before, but not to the extent of what we see today was really derived from Jaws and Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And
well, it's going back to novels. Lord of the Rings, part of the reason it has its status is because it is fantasy. I mean, it was the first.
Yeah.
Or at least the first big one like that.
The first modern fantasy. You had your fairy tales and stuff, and you had your King Arthur and stuff like that. But definitely the first. There's definitely a fantasy before Lord of the Rings and after Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. And then I think there's a lot of movies like that, like before Star Wars, after Star Wars.
Yeah.
Or, you know. Well, that's why, I was wondering one thing about this. Like Avatar. Everyone, it was wonderfully popular. But is it substance enough to be a classic in 10 years? I mean, technology-wise, maybe, but is that enough?
I think the jury's still out on that because it's a very divided camp right now. I don't think that, even despite how much money it made, I don't think it will have quite the power of Star Wars just because we're in such a blockbuster-heavy period right now. I don't know. It's hard for me, but then you never know. There's some kids will grow up with, it's like, oh, man, Avatar, that was a movie that changed my life.
Zach, when we were on this mission trip, he was wanting to beat up some of our kids, but they had never seen Star Wars. And we're like,
how?
What are you doing? What are you watching? I mean, granted, I grew up, I was born in 1980, you know, the year of Empire Strikes Back. And my parents showed it, but I sometimes feel like parents aren't showing their kids formational important. I mean, even if you don't like Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an important movie. I mean, like, the entire culture can, you know, it's, quote lines from it.
It is amazing, actually, for as much of a cinematic society as we are, how some kids can be very cinema illiterate in a lot of ways. And movies that, you know, have made a huge impact on our culture.
And they still just, are.
And still are, but
we're sometimes not talking Citizen Kane, you know, which I think everyone should watch, but it's a little less accessible.
Yeah, and it's not like everyone has to see Citizen Kane. Now, if you're going to do anything, if you're going to be interested in film and try to be a film buff at all, you have to see Citizen Kane. But other than that,
so I'm going to jump off the Avatar. The other one I had, another of the things that it needs to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
This is a tricky one because there are some, I think there's popular in the citizen sense and there's popular in the critical sense.
Yeah, how many Best Pictures, Best Picture Oscar winners from the past have we never heard of? Like, no one knows anymore.
You know, and then there's some classic films that no one watches outside of film school.
This is true.
And I don't know whether that's because we're cinematically illiterate, mm-hmm. or whether, while it was foundational, it's really not a story that holds up over time.
It's an interesting thing, because
this is what I think Avatar might be. You know, maybe, say even it is foundational in this whole technology aspect. It was real popular, but maybe it's not foundational enough, or maybe it's not,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't last in the subconscious of culture enough.
That is an interesting point, because you do have that branch of books or movies that are really influential and inform the creator's work, but is not necessarily prominent in public consciousness. Yeah. Interesting. I was going to tell Brian this sometime about our cinema selections. I've actually somewhat recently, seen two different cartoons that actually included elements from movies that we've talked about in cinema selections, which, you know, Brian doesn't pick the most well-known stuff, but like there's an entire episode of Tailspin called Lost Horizon. Lost Horizons, which basically mirrors that movie. Like Baloo actually lands in this like secluded area, except I think they call it Pandala because it's like populated by panda bears and they appear to be all very peaceful, except in an inversion in this one, like after Baloo leaves, they follow him and they go attack Cape Suzette, and there's this entire like war scene. Very ironically, I heard this episode was actually pulled from syndication for a while because it's very tame by today's standards, but it's actually like warfare with like these animals and stuff. And then more recently, in Phineas and Ferb, I saw a reference to Night of a Hunter. There was a character who had like the letters tattooed on her fingers.
Nice.
And she did the whole like wrestling with her hands thing. Like, kids would never, most adults wouldn't even recognize that reference. But these films are in these creators.
That's the thing, because I think there's a certain aspect of classical movies, music, books that are classical in the sense that they influence the creators.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're going to be a creator, you have to see what came before, but they haven't lasted in popular culture for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's true. But they still influence the works.
Yeah, exactly.
The Battleship Potemkin is a very big example in film.
I know a number of directors who, you know, that's a big one. Citizen Kane always comes up. I read, maybe it was an article you sent me about the new Batman movie.
Okay, yeah.
Influenced somewhat, the cinematography was somewhat influenced by Metropolis.
Oh, yeah, that's
because
right.
The up and down economic thing.
Right, right. But at the same time, like we said, you'll have some that are movies or books that might have been critically praised at the time, but no one really remembers them.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's the popularity from the audience, that's something that you really can't predict. For it to be a classic, there has to be something that really resonates with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Treasure Island wasn't the first adventure book around Robert Louis Stevenson's time, but it became a very influential, you know, there's motifs from there that repeated themselves, the treasure map
that's partly why we need time to determine classics, so you can kind of see which of these still resonate with people after 10, 20 years.
And it's interesting that sometimes even these famous authors, some of their other works won't. I mean, hardly anyone remembers any of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's books besides Sherlock Holmes, even though that frustrated him at the time. Robert Louis Stevenson, people remember Treasure Island, Kidnapped, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There's also a really cool medieval book that he wrote called The Black Arrow, which is kind of fun Robin Hood stuff, but it's not really nearly as famous as the other ones are.
Yeah, that's, it's interesting because when you find an author, then you can start reading the lesser works and think like, oh, this is still good. Yeah. Or, and sometimes you can only see a little difference between why this went off and that went off, but usually it's some sort of just, I guess it's... I'm going to throw in my third one here.
Okay, go for it.
Which is, it has some sort of universal, powerful idea. Something that touches the audience, that lasts over time.
Yeah.
And I think this is what classical books, like Les Mis. Mm-hmm. I mean, half of Les Mis is steeped in 18th or 19th century French geography and history and stuff. But it lasts because the themes are so powerful.
Are still universal.
Because there's some, I mean, and that's why it's, I think a lot of people read the abridged version. They cut out all the, not like Victor Hugo just loved Paris and constantly, there's like 50 pages about the Battle of Waterloo and, you know, all this French history that it's kind of hard for an American who doesn't, unless you know your French history, at least a little bit.
Sure.
But so much of the, you know, the guilt and redemption and loss and it's just done really, really well.
And it's all tied into that to an extent.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what, you know, Hunchback of Notre Dame, I haven't read, same sort of, I don't know, okay, Victor Hugo still again, you know, but keeps getting remade because there's certain ideas that keep fascinating people. I think that's why certain comic book heroes, you know, play well. And other ones, they might have interest in comics, but they never play well in a popular setting.
They never, yeah, it's true, they never get as big as, like, as cool as the Atom is, he's never going to be quite as popular as Superman.
Because yeah, he just doesn't have the character dimension that make really gripping stories necessarily.
At least
you can do it in the comic. You might be able to write a whole series, you know, a good 6-issue thing, really digging into him. But yeah, he's not inherently awesome,
right? and I wonder if there's certain genres or whatnot that there's a certain threshold of interest in it. Like, I mean, you're gonna have a lot of people will read Lord of the Rings just to see what the big deal is, yeah. But then a certain percentage of that will go on to read more fantasy stuff. I mean, I love Lord of the Rings, but I haven't gone and read, you know, End of Time or The Wheel of Time
that's kind of what people have. But.
Okay, but I'm not a big fantasy fiction reader.
Well, that's the interesting thing. Classics also change the more narrow your genre gets. You know, classics in the general sense, you know, Lord of the Rings, when you get into a fantasy setting, then you start...
That's
true.
Any
other novels, you know. Mm-hmm. You got, my brain went dead. But there's all kinds of, you know.
Subgenres.
Like... You know, if you're fantasy, then here's the classics in fantasy, which a general audience might not even care about.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the classics in mystery. And then you might get Father Brown, who you never would hear about.
Yeah, that's true.
In a general sense.
What was that, remember that chart I sent you, or you sent me with the, like, all the different, there's a, like a long, big flow chart if you're interested in like fantasy science fiction.
Yeah.
And like there are all these different avenues, you know, military science fi, try this, or not on a different planet, on this planet, try this one and stuff like that. And I mean, like $100, some books on this thing.
And most of them I recognize name wise, even though I've never read them or don't know what they're about.
But they generally can be kind of divided into all these little subgenres. And yeah, most of them aren't going to be classics. Well, it's sort of like what we talked about back in the originality thing. Sometimes if you try to be too original and too setting this thing, when you're trying to set too much new ground, then there's not going to be people interested in it as much because they don't know where to come at it sometimes. Yeah. But then other times you come up with something completely out there, like, say, Avatar The Last Airbender. That's a pretty new and original kind of show, and it manages to grab a huge audience.
It is balanced being original and being also having those universal ideas.
Yeah.
You know.
Because, I mean, Avatar borrows from a lot of stuff. Like Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, exactly. And we're at the point now, especially in media, where there's a lot of derivative sounds wrong. And so I don't mean derivative in the bad sense, but there's a lot of history behind most of what people are writing. Mm-hmm. Most people are writing not like this. And I guess it's always been that way. But like the really old stuff, like Homer, you don't know what he got it from.
Yeah.
He's all that's left.
That's true. I mean, and I think cinema is kind of coming into that same thing maybe a little early, just because it's such, you know, there's so much being done, but it does get harder and harder for creators even there. I mean, I talked about how in some ways, you know, we've seen in the last 100 years, you could point to a lot of different genre setters, if you will, but probably more difficult nowadays. I mean, like...
Well, we're doing things like Hugo, which is basically praising old movies. I mean, you're having movies about old movies.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in a very new setting with new technology, but it's about old movies.
And it's not a bad thing, but we're already at the spot where we're
looking
referencing
back
to each other.
I wonder,
I don't think it's bad.
I wonder if video games will continue to be the next sort of trying to set new boundaries and figure out... Because I know they're still experimenting a lot with trying to...
How you make choices and...
Mm-hmm, and it may not make the cinematics kind of overwhelm it, so you feel like you're playing a movie and making a different kind of storytelling experience.
Yeah, the only thing... I think there's a lot of storytelling potential in video games. I just don't know sometimes whether the interactive part of... You know, the more you give choice to the player, the less it becomes universal, because mm-hmm. then everything becomes so personalized, and your stories don't get as, I don't know.
It's tricky though, Nick, because we haven't played a lot of the modern
stuff.
Played
modern stuff. Yeah, I'm talking completely theoretical at this point. You know, I'm still like, you know, it's a Saturday. I'm like, I'm going to start up my Final Fantasy VI on my Super Nintendo.
So, yeah, I know they've said Mass Effect has a very interesting in terms of like storyline and how it, because I guess the Mass Effect series, from what someone was telling me,
we know nothing.
Yeah, we really don't. But I guess like the choices you make in the first game carry on into the second game.
Really?
And then into the third game.
Now that's pretty cool.
Because like it probably takes a lot of space in your Xbox hard drive or what have you. But I guess like, you know, people talk about this stuff online all the time. And I guess I heard that like some people playing Mass Effect 3, which came out fairly recently, they'll be describing something and other people are like, really? I don't have anything like that going on.
Weird.
Like, your choices will actually change the world. And so then there's, like, you know, you have to consider the consequences.
That's gotta be complicated to put together.
I imagine so. Now, from what I understand, a lot of people, there's a big uproar about the ending for it.
Okay.
So it's like, it was another one of the endings are really hard.
Yeah, especially on a game that gives, how many different endings do they have? Or do they just kind of meld them into one somehow?
I think the problem was, they meld all these experiences into, like, three different endings.
Oh.
So I think that might have been a big problem.
And endings are hard anyway. I mean, a really good, solid ending for a important story.
Especially for an ongoing one like that.
Yeah.
But we've gone a long way from classics.
Yeah, that's true. Then my fourth thing was that it has to be technically good.
Mm.
I don't know if it has to be. Like, that helps. I mean, if you're only technically good, like you're... But you don't have the popular appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily work. But if you're...
I think you're technically good would probably fall in fairly well with the genre setting thing.
Oh, okay. I can see that.
I mean, I agree. That's definitely a part of it. And you're not going to see something famous have bad writing. At least...
Yeah. Not generally.
Not generally.
Unless occasional happen if the ideas are so... Like Ayn Rand. Fountainhead and... What's the other one with
Ayn Rand, the author.
With John Galt. What's the Fountainhead, the one I read. What's the other one?
I'm not sure.
I really should know the exact one. I've heard people complain about the writing style. It's not... Like, when I read Fountainhead, I didn't mind it. But there's just a lot of text for not necessarily a lot of stuff. And sometimes people say that in real time. Too much description and not enough. So they'll make technical assaults on it. But the ideas are so captivating that people don't care about the literariness.
Uh-huh.
Once they hit a certain threshold, you know, once you're telling a good story, they don't care that it's that extra 10%.
That's a good point. And I guess that you could say that for a lot of pulpy sort of things. Like, although Flash Gordon, for example, I'm sure is very influential. I know that's a big influence for Star Wars. Although no one really remembers. I mean, there's a very small audience that still follows and remembers finally Flash Gordon stuff.
Godzilla. I mean, that's a classic, but
it's ridiculous.
Well, the first one's not quite as ridiculous.
Okay, I'm not sure if I actually seen
the first original Japanese one is much more serious.
Okay.
Than the later ones get.
But still, you're talking about like a giant lizard that like stomps
up. Well, exactly. Stuff. Yeah, I know. But it's very influential after that.
Uh huh.
And it's basically a some sort of sci-fi old movie classic.
That's true.
But technically, it is kind of pulpy, kind of a lot of the Tarzan stuff's
sure
not bad writing by any means. But from an English professor's point of view, it's a little more sensationalized. A little over the top.
Right.
Which is part of the appeal, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes that's...
And maybe,
really interesting, meaningful stories that way.
And maybe it's not so much that you're technically awesome, but that you're technically powerful. I mean, that you can almost break away from the norm and be better. If that makes sense within certain limits.
I think so. There's a certain amount of, let's say, to use a phrase that I use in describing Doctor Who,
yeah,
emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
It's like it touches on your emotions, on the parts that wants to imagine and big things, yeah, and stuff, even if it's not the most logically consistent sort,
yeah,
of story.
Yeah, because it has to touch your emotions and simultaneously move the form forward in some way.
Mm-hmm. And something that sets up these iconic,
yeah,
sort of
things. And being iconic is probably the most important thing in some ways.
Right.
I mean, that's why Night of the Hundred, the things on the,
right,
fingers, I mean, that shows, mm-hmm, up in other places, too.
Yeah. And, you know, going back again to our originality episode, you know, we talked in that one about how, in some ways, originality is overrated, that, you know, you should just try to tell the story that needs to be told and,
yeah,
not be too caught up in how original it is. But at the same time, the more original some of your, I mean, plot structure-wise, that's maybe not as important, although, you know, you have something really crazy original plot structure, like, say, Memento,
yeah,
in which people remember it for that. But I wonder if it's more characters and stuff. It's hard to define how much is original, how much is not,
yeah,
original enough. It's,
and it has to be very much itself. I mean, can't feel,
yes,
like it's,
right,
trying. Like, it can't feel like it's trying.
I was watching a Comic-Con panel for Phineas and Ferb the other day, which Nick knows that this is my new favorite cartoon. It's such an intelligent kids cartoon and stuff. It's really one of the most modern things that's like right up there with Last Airbender, Legend of Korra. Animation that the entire family can enjoy.
Yeah.
And anyway, the creators, producers, they were saying how a lot of their decisions get spaced, I mean, not solely, but they often go in directions of what's not being done in kids shows nowadays. I think that's where, like, the design for the character of Phineas is basically, his head is like a triangle.
Yeah.
And someone asks him, why a triangle? And he's like, well, I've never seen a cartoon character whose face is basically shaped this way. So he was experimenting. Another person asked him, have you ever thought about having a rival for such and such character? And they were like, no, we see a lot of shows doing that, and we kind of felt like we didn't really want to. And it's little decisions like that that really make it stand out as, you know, something unique. It's something
not following the crowd, just,
right,
having a sense of, you know, yeah,
not feeling like we have to do such and such storyline because every show like this does.
Well, that's why it's, you know, my unofficial subtitle for this podcast was of story school is not just what makes it a classic, but what was it? Why every fantasy is the next Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
And actually, it's not so much that now. For a long time, it was like, this is the next Lord of the Rings, or this is the best world since Tolkien, or
now
because they're death, and that's not even the point. I mean,
it's now the time is like, this is the next Harry Potter, or this
next
is the
Hunger Games,
the next Twilight. Yeah, yeah.
And that's missing the point.
Yeah.
You don't want to be the next Lord of the Rings. You want to be the next what it hasn't been yet.
See, this is the thing, though, where marketers and artists always differ. Marketers like having things be similar to something else that was popular,
yeah,
because then they know how to sell it.
Yeah.
Artists like, no, it doesn't work that way.
which, I mean, if you're the next Lord of the Rings, meaning it's the next thing that's as intriguing or as
expansive, like, epic.
Yeah, because when I first started Wheel of Time, there was Piers Anthony or Orson Scott Card had something on Eye of the World, like best world building or in the an air of Tolkien or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, as far as the sort of moral, atmospheric writing style of Tolkien, there's nothing like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have an entire, its own moral, socio-economic world building thing that's completely its own, and which is why I like it, and I think why everyone else fell in love with it, because it did its thing really, really well. But I couldn't compare it to Tolkien. I mean, it doesn't feel anything like, I mean,
uh-huh,
there's some similarities in the first book of, you know, leaving their hometown and running from people chasing them and stuff,
sure,
like that.
But that's just the hero's journey.
Exactly. So.
Well, we've had quite an expansive discussion,
yeah,
about
actually,
this.
Actually, that went longer than I thought it might.
And I don't know what the takeaway, I guess this is not one I'm going to try to summarize because, like I said, we don't know, there's no formula for making
so,
a classic.
Real quick question. What makes a cult classic?
Actually, I don't know if I ever mentioned this on the podcast before, but I had a professor say something about...
Oh, I think
about,
did, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll just reiterate it, even in case I did say it, that he suggested that a cult classic actually has something wrong with it, sort of a flaw that kept it from being popular on a widespread scale, and that it becomes a cult classic because certain people see, you know, they fill in that flaw with their own self. It's like the whole abstract thing.
Okay.
The more abstract something is, then you're able to kind of project your own beliefs and impressions on it.
So it attaches very intensely, but with a subset of people.
I think so.
And the Labyrinth is that way.
Yeah.
Either a subset of people are like, this is completely awesome, and other people are like,
what the heck?
Yeah.
And when he said that, I objected to it a little bit at first because he put it in sort of a negative turn, like there was something wrong with it. But when we talked about it, it's like, okay, I understand where you're coming from, and that, yeah, there was some reason that it didn't affect. And sometimes, just because there's something that you know is, you know, a little flawed or a little messed up about the story, that's all the more reason to like
it. Exactly. I mean, sometimes that's the reason. I remember, I don't know if I'd call it cult classic, but that was part of the reason I thought Blade in the Water was such a fascinating movie. I mean, mm-hmm. It drove people nuts because the structure is insane.
It's ridiculous, I mean, in some ways, yeah.
I think for a certain subsection of people, it's like, that's cool.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's something special about that.
They really like that idea.
Yeah.
You fall in love with that idea, even if, you know, you're not in love with entire movie.
So you have 10,000, so there's cult classics for everything now.
Well, that's the thing about the internet. You know, you meet people who are interested in the same thing, whether that's the most ridiculous thing in the world to be interested in or not.
Yeah, very true.
Good and bad. All right. Hopefully that made sense.
If you're listening to this, I'd like to hear what sort of classics you enjoy. I mean, sometimes you watch a classic because you want to know the history or where this came from or, you know, but there's some of them that are like, okay, this is really good. No wonder everyone reads this.
And then there'll be other ones and like, why?
Yeah, you're like, what was, like, oh, back in the day, this was the first time. And you're like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, some older movies that have influenced newer ones have kind of faded in response because it's been done so much bigger and better now in some ways.
There were stepping stones.
Yep, definitely. But all right, we'll move on because this has gone on long enough and go into our soundtrack. Soundtrack, Nick had this idea for his, and I'm totally stealing for this. We're both taking a song from a very classic video game series, Mario.
The theme that everyone and their brother knows. Probably most people around the world.
Probably. Although you're doing it, yours is from, which we'll play at the end of the show, is from the original Mario Brothers.
True. Yours is from.
Mine is from Super Mario World.
Which is not quite as known, but quite known.
But yes, still quite known. I think they still use it for various stuff. Yeah. You know, Mario, they reuse their own music a lot. Because, you know, it's Koji Kondo.
He can write so many wonderful melodic things.
Definitely. And so this is a remix from Super Mario World, very basic kind of theme. This is by Bladiator, and it's called Grand Valse Mario. Is that right?
I assume so. I don't know.
I'm not sure. Valse, Valais. Anyway, it's a very classical kind of piano solo, so I hope you enjoy. right, welcome back.
Yes, I really enjoyed that.
It's a really fun song.
It is.
All right, for our next segment, we present for you a bit of story. Okay, Nick, you better set this one
up. Okay, so we're going to talk about classics, and I'm like, hey, Tim, we need something to put in the second half. Why don't we have this journal from the Story Project that had some reference to classical books? And when I went back to it, it didn't have quite as much as I had thought.
But it still it ties in pretty well,
It fits pretty well. And the Story Project, again, if you're the first-time listener, shame on you. The Story Project was a project we did in 2005 and 2006, I believe, where about six of us wrote fictional journals of these people who lived together in this mansion. They were all writers, and they wrote journals
and
about what was happening.
And we posted them online. It was sort of like fictional blogs, basically.
And one of them was Brittany Bontrager, who was this 16-year-old girl. She was too smart for her own good, kind of overly emotional, kind of stubborn, you know, an interesting little quirky character. And this is written from her point of view. And it's Halloween. It's like right before basically everyone's going to go, the whole project gets dissolved.
Yeah, pretty close. So you'll hear her impressions of some of the other characters. The main one I guess you should know about is Vincent, who is kind of a...
Is it her uncle?
Her uncle, a very aloof kind of personality.
Germaphobe.
Germaphobe, but likes things very punctual. Sort of like a very dark version of Monk. To an extent.
Yeah, I can see that.
Not dark as in, like, depressing character, but dark as in, like, mysterious.
Mysterious. And this has been read by Brianna Lehman, who was once one of my students, and she hopes to go into writing, and I knew she'd like drama and stuff, so I'm like, hey, you want to read this for me? She's like, yes, absolutely. She was actually really excited about it.
Oh, that's cool.
So we stuck in her room and left her there, and this one came out.
That sounds really disturbing. Sounds wrong, Nick.
It sounds wrong.
How old is she again?
She's 18.
Okay, so pretty close to Brittany's actual age.
Yeah, because Brittany was, what, 16, I think, at that point.
I think, oh yeah, it sounds right.
So, yes, enjoy.
Amongst the Dead by Brittany Bontrager. October 31st. I wore a princess costume tonight. Originally, I was going to be more creative. I planned to dress in French peasant clothing and knock on each door while knitting, but when I told this to Sarah, she didn't get it. Are you a grandmother? She asked. I'm Madame Defarge, I explained heatedly. From Dickens! So then I thought I'd try again and dress like a French princess, but I'd wear a black mask over my head so that in the dark, it looked like I had no head. In one hand, I'd carry a cake. That was supposed to give it away. Sarah didn't get this one either. Marie Antoinette, I shouted after giving more than enough clues. You know, let them eat cake. If you're so set on being French, Sarah said, why don't you dress up as an order of French fries? You know, I like Sarah, but that was a really dumb suggestion. At least as a princess, people recognize me and I get to wear a pretty dress. I met everyone else in the dining room at 4:58. Last Saturday, everyone got an invitation delivered to his room. All it said was, meet in the dining room at 5:00 sharp on All Hallows' Eve. Please dress appropriately. The sender was a minor mystery in the mansion, until I explained it had to be Vincent. Who else would underline sharp and call tonight All Hallows' Eve? Everyone but Sarah was there already when I arrived. Bob resembled Mario rather convincingly. Dr. Zay wore a long brown coat and a scarf that reached to the ground and wrapped around him two or three times. It must have been more than 15 feet long. His hair was a mess. At his side was what looked like a metal dog. Judy had a picnic basket and a red riding hood. Lance wore the Hercules costume I made for him last school year. It caught me off guard to see him holding Miss Krieger's hand. I should not have to see my English teacher outside of school, and I certainly should not have to see her dressed up like Xena. I won't be able to concentrate in class the rest of the year. Katrina was dressed like Trinity from The Matrix. What is it about us writers, warriors and royalty all? Perhaps that's what we were all meant to be. Phil shocked me more than anyone. His hair was slicked. He wore professional spectacles, carried a briefcase, dress slacks, starched dress shirt, necktie. Nice costume, Phil, I said. Do you know who I am? Your good twin? Nope. A preppy? Closer. A snob. Not quite. What? I snapped. He kept smiling at me smugly, almost laughing. Just tell me! I'm the male version of you. I so wanted to slap him. Vincent entered at precisely 5. He wore princely clothes and an iron mask. Where was Sarah? I wanted to show her that Vincent, at least, had created a French outfit. A commentary on your brother? Katrina asked him. A way to filter the outside air, he said simply. He looked around. Where is Sarah? She told me she's coming, Bob said. She is late. We will begin without her. He looked at each of us again. This will be our last All Hallows Eve together. Am I right in reading the signs, Katrina? We looked at her. What do you want, Vincent? Yes, I have, then. It is well. Tonight we honor those who have left us. In the entry hall, you will find 6 large boxes full of books. These are the works of authors who are long dead. You will take these boxes into the city. When you knock on the door, instead of saying, trick or treat, you will hand them a book and say, here is your treat. Everyone was silent. I spoke out. Can we take their candy too? The purpose in giving the books is to enrich others, not to overindulge ourselves. Tonight is much more important than mere candy. But we can take the candy if we want to? I asked. That is not my concern, he said. I will remain here for any trick-or-treaters who may come to the mansion. Just then, Sarah rushed into the room, waddling awkwardly in her costume. Am I late? She was an order of French fries. None of us were very eager to start. Not only was it a dumb idea, it could only be embarrassing. We had all met tonight because Vincent called us. Everyone respected Vincent, if only a little, because he never asked anything of us. I think that's the only reason we heaved the heavy boxes of books and headed into town. Bill and I rode with Bob and Sarah. When we found a good street with lots of lights on in the windows, we split up. Sarah tried to go with Bob, but I wasn't going to get left with Phil tonight. Not tonight, when I already knew I was going to be a fool. Even walking around with a pack of French fries is better than trotting with a bad imitation of myself. As Sarah and I held the box between us and struggled to walk, Sarah fell more than once because of her costume, I glanced at the spines in the light from the street lamps. Chesterton, Austin, Dumas, Collins, Melville, Hawthorne, Tolkien, Homer, Dickens, Hugo, Bunyan, Dante, Carroll, Shakespeare, Tennyson, Verne, Swift, Tolstoy, McDonald's, Mallory, Louis Stevenson, Baum, Defoe. No one really wanted to read these books. They wanted to have read them. Sarah and I knocked on a door together. An older lady opened it, looked at us. I could tell she thought us too old for trick-or-treating. I pulled out Idylls of the King at random. Here's a treat from us, I said. Sarah nodded her head and said, yep, take it. Happy Halloween. So guiltily that I'm sure the lady thought we were nuts. We scurried away from the door. Again and again we did this. Sometimes we'd get a hesitant thank you. Sometimes the person would laugh as if we were 8 years old and try to give us candy instead. But I remember one young man who stared at us uncomprehendingly, then after a moment said, do you have The Man in the Iron Mask? I saw the movie. I thought the book might be better. We did have it. Sarah handed it to him. He thanked us. We still had a few books. I had purposely avoided giving away Les Miserables. Hey, Sarah, you want any of these? Well, I thought I'd take Journey to the Center of the Earth if no one else wanted it. And this one's mine. Well, only a few more to get rid of, then. And as Sarah and I stumped down the street, looking for a house, passing decorations of skeletons and cobwebs and coffins, I realized we carried dead men in the box between us, and that these men spoke whenever someone opened the covers of these books. The coffin of their thoughts. Their voices, whether right or wrong, spoke still as if they sat beside us. And this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to write. It was a sobering thing to realize whatever I wrote might be saved forever, that it might express my pig-headed ideas, or that it might still speak truth long after I had died. How is it that my uncle, so fearful of people, knows what people need more than those who are such people? I gave the last two, The Man Who Was Thursday and Notes from the Underground, not caring if the people read them. Maybe they would. That was enough.
Okay, we're back.
So that was a glimpse into Story Project, kind of our occult classic. I was joking with Tim beforehand.
A very loose definition of the term.
But it was very important for us.
Yes.
I mean, it taught us a lot of stuff and lasted with us a long time.
Probably the most successful of our collaborative writing projects to date.
Today. So far.
So far.
But if you are interested, there are ebook versions for pittance.
And I think you could also buy a copy in print, right?
You can buy a print version still from
Lulu.com.
Yep. And print, and the ebooks are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords.
Mm-hmm. They're all over the place.
If you ever do read it, we'd love to hear from you.
Definitely.
You know, we've heard from like two people.
Yeah. All right. So we're not going to go into a really long segment of this, but we have a little extra time. Let's talk about our take
on Tales. Tim mentioned it earlier in the podcast, actually, but The Legend of Korra.
Yeah.
Has recently ended. Well, a couple months, probably by the time this comes out. I was late to the show.
A month or two, yeah.
I watched it after it was all over on Nickelodeon. Actually, luckily I'd watched it and then they cut off all, like, except the ones I'd just not watched.
That's right.
It was really close.
You are lucky because of that whole, like, DirecTV thing.
But I really enjoyed it.
It's a great show.
It's very complicated, I think, to go from a show like Avatar, which became very, very, very popular. I mean, in its circle.
Yeah.
And then try to do it again.
But they were smart in not trying to make it immediately after the series and go way in the future.
They kept enough of the stuff we love about, you know, characters who are related, so we have a kind of a sense of place, but they've moved the technology forward. Mm-hmm. It was a girl instead of a guy. Aang's very laid back. She's very
aggressive.
Impetuous.
Yeah.
And the animation, top notch.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. Yeah, definitely a very interesting move of trying to make it this same universe, but in a very different show in a lot of ways.
And like Tim pointed out, it's very political. I mean, when he was talking to me earlier, very political in some ways. It's a little bit like the prequels of Star Wars compared to the originals. You know, the originals are, you know, the original, there's an empire taking over and you're the rebel, real small person trying to win. Mm-hmm. And this is like, it's all established and things are eating it away from the underbelly.
Right. It's society is overall good. It's not like we're in a major war. There's a major bad guy. I mean, there is a bad guy, but yeah. He's not threatening all life as we knew it, at least not at first.
Now, I will have to say, and this, spoilers. Mm-hmm. I felt like the ending was too fast. I feel like we need like two or three more episodes.
It was a little bit. And I know some people were a bit disappointed in the fact that they sort of felt like the bad guy had some interesting point to a certain extent. And that's the people who couldn't do the special bending powers were a little looked down. And that was never really addressed again later on.
What's weird, it's called Republic City and five benders are in charge of it. One from each tribe. That's not a republic, is it?
Well, I guess originally, like Sokka was originally part of first part, and he was not a bender.
That's true. And so maybe each of the continents just happened to elect a bender.
Yeah, it's possible. Like I noticed, there's two water.
Well, the North and South.
The North and South waterbending tribes, but yeah, not necessarily North and South water tribes, I should say. But we don't know. Those other three members,
that's true.
We don't really know what they were or not.
My other thing is, like, I like the Amon's backstory, but it just felt, sloppy's not the right word, but why we need more time. Second last episode, we have massive expositional download.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's interesting to me, though, because I felt like when they revealed that Tarlok had such a powerful ability, and then they showed his father, the other bender, I was like, there has to be some connection.
Well, that's true.
It just didn't. It wouldn't have felt natural if there had been suddenly these two powerful ones, and then Amon just happens to be this other guy with other really unusual ability.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. Well, I don't know. I just felt like the last about, you know, the ending two-parter really just need more space. I felt like, you know, he takes, because for like, it's what, 11 episodes, 12 episodes?
Yeah.
For like 8-9 episodes, we got about 3 episodes getting you into the show. Then after that, like every episode, Korra and her friends just lose.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And then at the end, she doesn't so much win as reveal. I mean, I don't know. I just want more time at the end, I think, for a switch, for a military battle, for, well, like, it seems like the thematic point of the show, of the first season, was to get her to connect to her spiritual self.
Yeah. And but, to be able to let go of... Cause...
So she... Yeah, get let go so she can do air and be a full avatar.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, she loses all her powers but air, which is kind of cool. And then in like 3 minutes, she has all this... She hits bottom, Aang comes out and heals her. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it felt too fast.
Which, I understood that.
I'd rather, if you want to have another season, end it with her with no powers.
Uh-huh.
Have a whole... Because I just remember from the first... From Airbender, or Last Airbender, you know, there's a whole episode where he's wrangling, do I really want to be a hero, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that would help a lot.
Well, I heard, actually, that at one time, I think they were only scheduled to... This show was only scheduled to be, like, 13 episodes or something. And then they picked up for another, like, half season or whatnot.
Oh, okay.
So they may have already planned this whole arc, and then it was going to end
there. It ended very, very, everything's tied up.
Yeah. Which was very surprising.
Yeah.
Especially since, yeah, like you said, considering the way the second season of Avatar ended, who knows how it would have
been. You could tell, though, I think the first show had, I think they started out kind of at a adventuresome kid level, and then they kept pushing it.
Mm-hmm.
But they had you know, a normal kid show number of episodes, so they had time to be silly. They had filler episodes that they could have fun with and expand things.
Mm-hmm.
And this really, I like shows that have limited amounts, so you can get all the intense stuff there. I felt like one or two more episodes would benefit, not... Like really enjoyed it.
Like maybe 13 was a little on the short side. Yeah. And I know they've said that they were very purposely trying to keep it a very tight arc. Like, because they said they were inspired like by a lot of cable shows nowadays that have these very tight. I think like shows like Mad Men and stuff like that, they have very short seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's something to that.
No, and I think then you can focus really well on the ones you're saying. Yeah. And I just felt like another episode. For emotional, you know, for mm-hmm. the tying things up.
Yeah, yeah. And I know where you're coming from. I think it would have been a really harsh way to end it with her only...
Well, you wouldn't have to do that, but somehow give her time while they're picking up the pieces or something. Mm-hmm.
I saw one interesting... one commentator had a really interesting interpretation of that last scene. Because there's a shot of where, like, you just... I think you see a tear falling over. And this commentator speculated that maybe she might have been considering suicide, but they can't actually show that on a Nickelodeon and a kids show.
Which would
make sense, because her whole identity was tied up in being able to do all these things, and now she doesn't have any of that. I mean, aside from the airbending, but she doesn't know anything about airbending at this point.
Yeah.
And she clearly can't be an avatar, virtually, without... doing the other
stuff. I do have to say, all the characters were great. They make... the great thing about Korra and Last Airbender, even the minor characters are awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, every character is genius.
Very colorful.
Very, mm-hmm. very colorful world. I love having, you know, some of the relatives in there.
Yeah.
Like Toph's daughter.
Yeah, daughter. Mm-hmm.
Who was great. And just,
What's
Kenzen? Kenzen's awesome in his family with all the kids.
Oh, Tenzin.
Tenzin. Thank
you. Yeah. Yeah. His family is great.
I feel like the writers must have more kids now.
That could very well be.
I don't know. It just feels like you have this, everyone's more grown up and have kids. It is a more grown up show. I mean, everyone's taller.
That's true. Well, it felt like very much similar to Harry Potter sort of thing.
Yeah, they grow up with the people.
Mm-hmm, with the audience in a certain...
So, very, very much worth your time.
Oh, yeah,
One
of the best shows. One of the best shows that was on TV this summer.
It was very, very good.
Definitely.
Very entertaining. Even if you haven't seen Last Airbender.
But this is true.
You
should probably see it first.
It'll make more sense and more fun.
There'll be a few jokes that you'll appreciate more.
Cabbage Corp.
My Cabbage Corp. well, that'll do it for our Tick and Tales. Yep. I will throw out here one thing, just because it relates to our last episode. I did finish the Space Trilogy.
Oh.
And
you had told me that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say this, that Hideous Strength does not really fit into the whole world-building thing so much. That Hideous Strength is a very strange book in some ways, in, like, pacing and stuff.
It's very unique.
It is very unique, and yet still very Lewis. There's unmistakably Lewis, but it's unusual.
Yeah.
So take that as a...
Almost experimental.
In some ways, yeah, because I was telling him, Nick, it sort of feels like it changes genres in different places. Like, it's a drama of manners, and then it's a dystopia, and then it's this spiritual warfare Ted Decker sort of thing. I mean, obviously not before Ted Decker, but And then by the end, it strangely feels like it turned into a farce. Just because how completely ridiculously the evil organization is overturned at the end. It's a weird thing. So
it's probably why it's one of the least heard about
Lewis books.
It's the hardest one probably for people to wrap their heads around.
Probably. Yeah. Well, and so now the next fiction, actually the last fiction of Lewis I need to read is Till We Have Faces.
Have you read Pilgrim's Regress?
No, I haven't read that.
Okay. Oh, that's half. That's not real fiction. Yeah, it's like half out. It's more mainly allegory.
Yeah, I think so. Have you?
I have not read that.
I guess the other thing I would, I don't know if it's, have you looked at The Dark Tower at all?
I don't. Yeah, I've heard about it. I know nothing about it.
Okay. And I think Ransom is supposed to be in it. So I really? I think the rumor is that it might have been the sequel to Perelandra, and then he scrapped it and went with That Hideous Strength.
Hmm.
I don't know. There's some interesting rumors about
that. Yeah, I'd like to hunt that up sometime.
So, yeah. It was not completed, obviously.
Yeah.
But, all right. Anyway, we better wrap this one up.
This will be a long one for once.
Yeah, it's been a little while. But next time, we'll hopefully have more of our ramblings that you'll enjoy. If you ever need to find us on our website, that is derailedtrainsofthought.blogspot.com.
You can email us at derailedtrains@gmail.com. And subscribe to us on iTunes.
Yep. Look us up there. And because the more, the merrier.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
All right. My soundtrack today is from, as we said before, the original Mario Brothers. It is called
Super Mario Brothers.
Super Mario Brothers. Okay, I guess it's not the original Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Super Mario Brothers from the Nintendo. It is called Mario Likes Thorazine. I don't know why he's on drugs, but he is. it is remixed by, and again, I always pick the ones I can't pronounce, Schnabulabula. Schnabulabula. Anyways, it's kind of a string quartet feel, but it's very interesting.
Classical theme, classical music.
Classical music, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Cool.
So I guess we'll bow out. They're really telling us to be quiet. I think they're going to jump out pretty soon here.
Okay.
They all got swords. I don't know what's going to go on here.
The only thing I brought with me today was this bamboo stick, so I'm not sure what we're gonna do here.
Well, I do have a pen, and you know what they say about
that is mightier than.
Yeah. So we'll be sad.
Okay.
All right.
Hopefully, we'll see you folks next time. This has been Tim.
This has been Nick.
Adios.
Bye.
Look, if we built this large wooden badger,